Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 49, The Unruh Effect. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/49. Show notes include links to the papers we read for this podcast, related episodes, and other things we discussed on this podcast. And now, Jim and Randy. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
All right, Jim, it's good to hear from you. Well, we're going to cover a surprisingly challenging subject that I think a lot of people heard about but had never really investigated in any depth, much like myself and Richard Feynman. Apparently, this was on his to-do list to learn about the Unruh effect before he died. I don't think he ever got around to it. The intricacies of this are a lot more beguiling than I expected. It's interesting stuff, and it's sort of at the cutting edge still after 40-some years in the theoretical literature. So we're going to go over the Unruh effect and talk about what it means for today and the future.
Okay. What is the Unruh effect really known for? I think it's really for the stuff that he doesn't talk about very much in this applications paper. The Unruh effect and its applications by Crispino, Higuchi, and Matsis.
This is a great paper. I'm really delighted that you found this in the literature because there are hundreds and hundreds of papers about the Unruh effect. And this one seemed like a nice global overview that really got into the nitty gritty and provided tons of references. It almost felt like a review paper.
I thought it was a review paper. It's not a review paper?
Well, it's from, I guess, reviews in modern physics. So I guess it is a review paper in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely a review paper. It's not really a research paper. It's really going over the things that are elsewhere, and it's giving you a lot of references, and it's pretty heavy going. I think we should warn people who are reading along that it's a little tough.
But it does seem very authoritative and very meticulous, so I have a lot more confidence in the work that I see here than I've seen in a lot of the other papers, especially some of the recent papers, which are challenging different aspects and interpreting it in different ways that, you know, seem a little off the norm. I looked at a bunch of those papers. I think I sent you a list of about 9 different papers that I looked over, and I was uncomfortable with a whole lot of them for various reasons, but there's still a lot of controversy and confusion about this effect, and this one seemed to get really, really into the brass tacks, and I felt a lot more confident when I read this paper that we were getting the real truth, you know?
I can see that. I mean, it's really going through the derivation, and it's going through different situations and things like that. So it tells you quite a bit about what's going on with the Unruh effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people are aware that the Unruh effect is a situation where quantum field theory predicts that if you have an observer that is accelerated, you know, at an extreme rate, the quantum field itself appears a temperature. It'll have like a black body radiation spectrum. It's really extreme. I mean, if you have a constant acceleration of 2.6 times 10 to the 20th meters per second squared, then it produces a temperature of 1 Kelvin. And this is something that the accelerated observer and the inertial observer in the rest frame, they both see this temperature. So it's a real effect. But that's an extremely high rate of acceleration. You know, I think it's far, far beyond any of our – I think there's a linear accelerator that was mentioned in this paper that produces like 10 to the 16th meters per second squared. But even that is a few orders of magnitude shy of producing 1 Kelvin. So, you know, any possible effect here would be like, you know, 1/10,000th of a Kelvin, that kind of thing.
It was pretty small, but on top of that, so I guess in that particular case, they actually said it wasn't too bad. It was, you know, 0.7 Kelvin was the estimated effect. But the analysis is a little more complicated, you'd like, if you're actually looking at the effect.
Okay, was that an existing linear accelerator, or is that the one in California they talked about in this paper?
I think it was SLAC that they were talking about, and I think that was an analysis from the 80s.
The problem is, how do you tease out that tiny little energy signal when you've got something blasting forward at that kind of rate for such a short period of time that's being subjected to all kinds of wiggles and, you know, everything else from the machinery itself, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right. It was actually 7/10 of a microkelvin.
Holy shit.
But they still said it's much smaller than the ordinary background temperature, but that doesn't cause a substantial problem because the background thermal bath is damped for relativistic electrons. That is, if you've got something accelerated really fast, that background temperature isn't that interesting to those electrons in the slack.
Sure. Yeah. So how do you detect that little bit of energy when it's already got that kind of momentum, right? Well, still, the nice thing that I liked about this paper was that they showed, you know, meticulously and step by step how you derive the Unruh effect from existing quantum field theory. So as they see it, it's as established as quantum field theory itself. Like, they don't feel like you need to perform experiments in order to verify that it's real, because it's so based on the foundations of quantum field theory that it has to be real if quantum field theory is correct.
Yeah, that's exactly what they said.
But then if you look on Wikipedia and you look it up, they describe it as a hypothetical effect. You know, so there's still a lot of confusion about the validity of it.
Well, there are a couple of things. One is that, obviously, if you haven't detected it, then it's hypothetical. I mean, that's just the way the world works.
I think it would be more fair to call it theoretical, at least, because it is based firmly on theory. It's not just a supposition, you know.
And I think the other thing is that the question is not just is there the temperature change, there's the existence of the Unruh radiation, the particle radiation. And at least one of the papers that I read, there was sort of an issue with that, saying that, no, this Rindler observer should not really see real particles that are causing the heat, right? So, you know, the Minkowski observer, the inertial observer, would see the Rindler observer, the accelerated observer, as having a higher temperature, but he would never see any of those particles. So the question from this other guy is, you know, would that accelerated observer see particles that were associated with that acceleration? Would he see the radiation, which is similar to sort of Hawking radiation? The problem wasn't with the temperature. It was whether or not this guy would actually see all of these particles.
I guess if all of the particles of the observer are excited by that temperature, then there's no temperature differential between him and the supposed particles from in his Rindler frame, right? So, like, how do you measure something if there's not a differential?
I mean, apparently, when you're talking about Unruh DeWitt detector, it will still see that for the inertial observer. The inertial observer will still see the detector from the guy in the Rindler frame, and that will still be detecting something, but he won't actually see anything that looks like particles. He'll think it has something to do with the accelerated temperature. So, an inertial observer doesn't see those particles, because there's no loss of information that's causing the particles to exist, like what's happening for the accelerated observer, for the Rindler observer.
Yeah, sorry. I meant to go over those definitions before we got started, because for some reason, you know, they like to name these things after people. So the accelerated observer, the one who's like going at, you know, 10 to the 20th or more meters per second squared, that's your Rindler observer, and they call that the Rindler frame that he's in. And then there's the inertial observer that never gets accelerated in the rest frame, and they call that the Minkowski observer. And they call the particles that are measured by the inertial observer, the Minkowski observer, Minkowski particles. So I guess the Minkowski particles are like real photons and so forth that you'd actually be able to detect like any other.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would expect that for the Rindler observer, for the accelerated observer, those particles, massless or massive, should still be particles. So it's just what he actually sees coming out of that field. Since a particle is just an excitation in a field, a photon is just an excitation of the photon field. What the accelerated observer sees is a different version of that field because he's accelerating.
It should be indistinguishable. I mean, to the Rindler observer, he must be seeing, because that's what a particle is. It's just he's in a different kind of reference frame, and so he's just seeing energy that he wouldn't be able to see otherwise.
Yeah, so he's seeing these particles that exist because he's accelerated, but they only exist while he's accelerating. So when he stops accelerating, they disappear.
They also use the terms Minkowski particles and Rindler particles. What's the distinction between those two? Why do they call them different things if they're experienced the same, you know?
Well, I think a big part of that is that normally you're looking at an unaccelerated field, right? Your coordinate system is unaccelerated. And so that inertial frame, those excitations are the Minkowski particles. The ones that you get from the accelerated frame, the additional particles from that, well, I guess I shouldn't say additional particles, but there are additional particles, but it's worse than that. Those other particles that go along with that accelerated frame are the Rindler particles. but the Rindler particles have a different basis than the Minkowski particles. They have different creation and annihilation operators. So there's sort of a mix between the inertial creation and annihilation operators, so that the creation of a Minkowski particle could be either a creation or a destruction of Rindler particle.
And that's where they got into the whole right and left wedges, Rindler wedges, right?
I'm not sure how important the right and left Rindler wedges are, because I think that's an artifice of working in two dimensions.
Oh, okay. I thought that applied to all.
While he introduced those, and I mean, it's interesting, but I was wondering while he was starting that what the difference between these two wedges are, except, you know, one, I guess, is the one that actually has the Rindler observer in it. If you have even one more dimension, if you have a 2 plus 1 instead of a 1 plus 1 space-time, now all of a sudden those two wedges are connected. So you have, like, an entire Rindler cone. Oh, I guess it's not a cone because it's everything but the cone, right?
It's a triangle, I guess.
The wedge is more like a triangle. I'm not sure what it would be called. Yeah, so it's like you had a big thing of ice cream and you just took out a cone-shaped piece of that ice cream. That's what's left over for the Rindler bit. That thing's completely connected, so now you have to think about it a little bit differently. Now, obviously, the accelerated observer, if he's actually coming at you in some way, that gives you sort of a preferential plane. But, you know, if you're in 2 plus 1 or 3 plus 1 dimensions, then you have more of these dimensions. You know, you can rotate that entire thing around. I think it should be completely symmetric when you do that, because you only have the one thing breaking the symmetry, which is the accelerated observer, right? So his acceleration sort of means that you're stuck with a kind of way to look at this.
I noticed in one paper that I glanced over that they were using the term Unruh Hawking radiation. And I like that because they have the same form of the equation and they seem like inescapably related.
Yeah, I mean, they are. I mean, in a way, what's going on is if you're this Rindler observer, if you're this constantly accelerating observer, there's a way in which the universe is cut off from you. Basically, there are places in the universe where no light can ever reach you and you can't get any signal from it. And so that acts sort of like an event horizon.
This is where the cosmological horizons came into the paper too, right?
So that's basically the idea, is that you're getting the Unruh radiation for a similar reason that you're getting the black hole radiation, the Hawking radiation.
And even though we don't have experimental proof that that's real, that seems like everybody assumes that that's true, I guess because it's got Stephen Hawking's name associated with it. But this is right there at the same level, right?
It's a very similar argument. I'm not sure that you have to agree with both of them, partially because, you know, that Hawking radiation is in a very, very extreme environment. I guess you're technically in an extreme environment if you're accelerating extremely fast, but that Hawking radiation is in a very extreme environment, so it's kind of easy to say, okay, something strange is happening there. The symmetries in this make it a little weird, right? I think that's one of the issues.
It's a rough argument to follow that derivation is daunting.
Yeah, I think this derivation was probably not meant for us, Randy.
Yeah, it was meant for specialists in the field.
Yeah, I think it was meant for people who already did a lot of this stuff and just wanted to look at something a little bit different. So yeah, it was pretty difficult. You know, I'd given up on this paper previously, and that's why when I sent you the recommendation previous to this, I sort of said, maybe we should do something else. I know this has a bunch of things in it that I think you're going to like, but it's a pretty rough paper. It's good. I just would rather have read it more times than once to try to get an idea about what was really going on.
You and me both. I was up all night slogging through this. I think after the first 10 pages, which were mostly derivations, I was ready for a Dramamine. And after the 20th pages, I was ready for a glass of wine. And after the 30th page, I was on my second glass of wine because I was like, oh, my God, my brain is just exhausted. But it's really well written, and it's a really rigorous argument. So I trusted it more than a lot of the shorter papers, which seem to be making claims that I didn't trust as much as the kind of treatment that we're seeing here, like the Sokolov-Turnov effect. One of the papers that we looked at here, and this was on the physical meaning of the Unruh effect by Akhmedov, Douglas, and Singleton.
That's Douglas Singleton. That's one person.
Oh, Douglas Singleton. Okay, sorry about that. That one was arguing that the effect in circular accelerators, the Sokolov-Turnov effect, where the polarization of electrons in a storage ring undergoes a certain kind of polarization, they argued that was proof of the indirect evidence of the Unruh effect. But in this paper, they seem to rule that out. Is that how you read it too?
I read it as it's not that clear cut. When I was reading the same bit about this, it sounded like the authors thought it should be there, but if you actually just look at all the problems with interpreting that data, you can't really pull that out of the data. There are many other things that could be going on. And so you need to be much clearer about what's going on. And there are some issues, like the actual measured effect doesn't look like the polarization that you'd expect from that analysis of the effect.
They seem to think it would be smaller and take much longer, and there are larger order magnitude effects that would create the same kind of polarization. You know, it doesn't seem like it's nearly as cut and dry. You know, you can't claim that we've detected this effect using that scenario. But there's some interesting work being done in that area. But one of the things that I wanted to touch on before we move into, like, the future experiments and all that kind of stuff that's going on now with, like, nonlinear crystals and all that, was blew my mind when I saw that the Unruh effect provides for proton decay. I was like, wait a minute, what? But yeah, apparently the Unruh effect gives you a pathway by which protons can decay into neutrons.
Okay, so I wasn't able to figure out from this what they were actually decaying into, but apparently it was neutrons that they're decaying into?
Yeah, apparently they can absorb energy from the Unruh radiation, the excitation energy, and become neutrons. And that stunned me because I had never even imagined anything like that. So, yeah, apparently if you can accelerate protons to, you know, some astronomical levels that, yeah, you can watch them change into neutrons. Love to see an experiment like that. Holy smokes.
Okay, did it actually – I thought that was pretty difficult even here.
Oh, yeah, and it's not within our current capabilities, but if we could accelerate protons to a sufficient – degree, then we should be able to detect that.
Well, I mean, that would be a really great experiment. I'm not sure how much it would cost, but do you remember exactly what the energy was that they needed?
Holy crap. You know, part of the problem that I had with this paper was that they didn't really give you too much in the way of numerical analysis. They just showed you the equation to figure it out yourself. I don't remember them doing an analysis that showed what it would take, like how fast you'd need to accelerate protons, but you know, I think we're probably looking at, you know, 10 to the 25th or more meters per second squared before you'd even get a detectable effect, you know. Because you have to reach, I guess, the energy level equivalent of the neutrino with the energy that would normally be emitted when a neutron decays. So you've got to get up to some pretty significant energies to fill that band gap, you know.
Well, they're saying 1 MeV. 1 MeV gives you a lifetime for the proton on the order of about a year. So, okay.
So you'd have to accelerate it for a year. Are they talking about... they have to be talking about more than 1 million electron volts in terms of this, the acceleration, right?
I don't think so. Yeah, it's around a year for 1 MeV. So, that's an energy, not an acceleration.
Yeah, I'm confused by that. Because we're well beyond that. I mean, we...
Yeah, but you'd have to accelerate the proton for a year. It's a lifetime, so it's not really a half-life, but to have basically a 50% chance of seeing it happen.
So you're talking about you'd have to accelerate it at a certain rate for a year. And that's kind of a problem, right? I mean, our linear accelerators only accelerate these particles for a fraction of a second, right? And then the storage rings, that's a whole other deal because they get up to a certain speed, but they're not accelerating past that speed. They're just cruising at that speed. So I think they're talking about you'd have to continually accelerate it. It's with, you know, an energy input every second for a year in order to get to that energy level where a proton would decay into a neutron, right?
It looks like if it were 1/10 of an MeV, it would take something along the lines of, 10 to the 30th years.
Oh, boy.
But if you got to about 10 MeV, maybe it would take, estimating from this plot, only about, 2 days.
Yeah, but I wonder what the final energy of the particle would be in that case. You know what I mean? Like, if you're accelerating something for a year solid at that 1 mega electron volt, and the problem is that's an energy and not a power. So it's, you know, I'm having a hard time figuring out what would the end product be. Like, would the proton have to be going for, after that year, it'd probably be at like 0.99999999999 the speed of light, right?
Yeah, it would be something like that. But yeah, it would be pretty quick. It'd be pretty quick, Randy.
The neat thing about that is if you could pull that off, then you could just stop accelerating it. You could detect the decay of neutrons into protons or into, you know, hydrogen or whatever the case would be, you know. So that would be a really clear signal. But again, you know, these are really extreme conditions. You know, I think intuitively you get so used to thinking about relativity where it doesn't matter what relative speed is between two reference frames. The laws of physics are the same. You can't tell that who's moving, who isn't, all that good stuff because it's relative. But in this accelerating situation, it's different. That's another situation. You know, you've got actual energy input going into this thing. So it's interesting that the laws of physics actually do change under acceleration, whereas they don't change for relative speeds, you know?
Yeah, this thing is interesting. I'm still not completely sure about this, but...
With the existence of the Unruh effect?
Well, I'm not completely sure about this decaying proton stuff. I mean, I'd really love to see it.
Yeah, I'd never even heard about this before until this paper, so I was really excited to hear about that.
You know, it's only been proposed since, what, 1964 is what they said?
I don't know. I don't remember that date.
I guess 1997 for the recent stuff. The stuff before the Unruh effect was 1964. Yeah, it's been since 1997 since they did this. So, yeah, it's pretty new. It's only 20 years old. Nobody talks about anything in physics for the first 50 years.
Yeah, they got to wait until you die before you become famous for predicting a new effect. It's kind of nice to see people, you know, live to see some of the fruits of their labor, you know. Unruh is one of them. He's still doing cutting-edge theoretical work.
Yeah, and he only discovered this like 50 years ago.
Yeah, so 76. So that's 43 years, I guess. But yeah, he's still alive and he's still doing great work. I noticed on his Wikipedia page that he's written a quantum field theory as a local theory. So apparently in some, you know, significant way, he feels that it's not actually non-local. So I really have to see his argument about that. That's really interesting.
Well, we can pick that up at some point if we can find it.
What I was kind of surprised that we didn't see in this paper was there was that article about testing Hawking radiation in laboratory black hole analogs, you know, where a researcher and his team are, you know, looking at nonlinear optical behavior in, I think, fibers, right? Optical fibers, and they were able to create a stimulated Hawking radiation in the lab.
Stimulated or simulated?
I think they stimulate the system so that it generates Hawking radiation, and then they're going to hopefully move towards a scenario where you get the spontaneous emission of Hawking radiation when you create a really perfect analog for a black hole optically.
Yeah, so that was by Leonhardt and some other people. Leonhardt's the guy who wrote the Science of Invisibility book, and, you know, that you sent me that Las Vegas list of weird things people were doing for the military or the NSA or somebody.
Wait, that was in there? Those are the papers, I think, that were created for the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program at the Pentagon.
Oh, yeah, for the, like, Blink 182 guy.
No. That came later. Tom DeLonge didn't get involved with the director of the AATIP at the Pentagon until, I guess, shortly before that guy left the Pentagon in 2017. So all those papers were solicited, I guess, from academia like 10 years earlier.
I wouldn't call it academia because I looked up some of those guys. This particular guy, the Leonhardt, I think his name is, because I don't have a reference next to me. He wrote that Science of Invisibility, and he was one of the people on that list. And you sent that, and I suggested, you know, these are some that I think would probably be good to talk about. I've referenced that. But, you know, he was just talking about, you know, simple metamaterial invisibility stuff that everybody knows all about these days.
Okay.
But not in the Science of Invisibility book. In the Science of Invisibility book, yeah, he talked about the metamaterial invisibility, but he also talked about creating optical analogs of black holes and stuff like that.
Okay, so that was the same researcher that they wrote that article about?
Yeah, he was on that team. So the two books, oh, it's Geometry and Light, The Science of Invisibility, which I think is like a 2011 book or something like that. Or at least the coffee shop receipt in here is from 2011. And so he did a bunch of stuff like that. And in one of those earlier papers, and he actually had an earlier paper like 2018 now, that criticized a previous attempt to do the exact same thing. And then the thing that you just sent me, the FizzOrg thing, that linked to a thing where he was now working with the people he'd criticized to make the thing work in a way that he thought was reasonable.
Yeah, well, that seems like a good way to go about it. I mean, it's a very delicate procedure, right? I mean, you're trying to work with, you know, the quantum properties of nonlinear optics in order to simulate general relativistic and quantum mechanical phenomena. It's so that you can learn about those, you know, because we can't study a black hole in the lab. So I imagine that's a really experimentally rigorous procedure. Both of those papers, by the way, are on the archive. So we'll take a look at those, you know. The measurement of stimulated Hawking emission in an analog system and observer of stimulated Hawking radiation in an optical analog. So that's a really interesting path forward. You know, one of the things that really amazes me and delights me about the Unruh effect is that it's right at that frontier where quantum field theory meets general relativity, or at least the, you know, Hawking radiation, which is directly related to this effect. So this is a domain where if we're going to learn anything about quantum gravity, this seems like the place to do it, right?
Well, I think that's what a lot of people think. They say as much in one of these papers. But since I read them both today and it's like 60 pages or something.
I know. I didn't get much sleep either.
Might know what they said, but I don't know who said it.
Yeah, I think it was in that review, the big review paper that we were slogging through last night.
Oh, were you reading it to somebody?
No. I said that we were slogging through. I wouldn't subject anybody else but me to reading this. Like, hey, sweetie, listen to this. You know, the non-inertial reference frame is co-moving with the detector and has an event horizon.
You are a charmer, Andy. You are a charmer.
Say more. Sweet talker, you.
I think you could do it like reading a play or something.
I don't think so.
You know, you could take part of the Rindler Observer. She could take the part of the Minkowski Observer.
Do an opera.
I didn't know you sang.
Don't, thank God.
I know you're now an international film star.
Yeah, because of my short film fest. Okay, so let's see. They also pointed out some sources of confusion about the Unruh effect that they've been seeing in the literature in this big review paper that we looked at. And that was interesting because there's papers even in the last 10 years that, you know, advanced theoretical physicists, you know, PhD level people examining this stuff like for a living, look at this effect and they're still seeing different things and there's still a lot of controversy and misunderstanding about it. So it really looking at the cutting edge of a subject when there's really a very tenuous consensus about what the meaning is of the results, you know.
I'm not sure what consensus means in this case. A lot of these things, I think, you know, it's the reason why you have an experiment.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them, it's not just, you know, you do the math and you see something, right? It's what are you allowed to assume when you do the math? What's actually happening when you do the math? And, you know, sometimes people can argue about that and they get it right. And sometimes people argue about that and they get it wrong.
Yeah, but and you can see from the derivation that it seems like pretty much every really sophisticated theoretical tool and mathematical construct that we've run into in both quantum field theory and general relativity all come together in this derivation to make it like the most opaque thing ever. So you've really got to have some expertise in both of those domains in order, I think, to make full sense of this derivation. And, you know, I don't think there's that many people that can do that.
Yeah, that might be true. You know, I assume there are plenty of them, otherwise they wouldn't have written a review paper.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's some, thank God, because, you know, it kind of blows my mind that there's anybody out there intelligent enough to do these levels, this level of derivations. But, you know, the fact that there's so much confusion in the literature still about it means that, you know, it's a tough thing to master. Not many people have done it.
Yeah, that's true. So let's see. Did you get much from... I did not get to the recent developments. What did you see in the recent developments?
Well, let me take a look at my notes here. They talk about all the different kinds of experimental approaches and proposed experimental approaches, observational approaches, static detectors and thermal bath Minkowski particles. Oh, yeah. And one of the things they mentioned that was interesting was they said about the discussion of whether or not uniformly accelerated sources radiate. They seem to think that this is like mostly a semantic argument, right? Like, are you going to call it radiation or vacuum actuations? Like, they say that would be a terminology thing. And I'm like,
some of it might be stuff like that, but, you know, I'm not completely sure. I mean, that's an interesting idea. Maybe you see vacuum fluctuations. If it's the same mathematics in the same field, then it's the same thing, whatever you call it.
Okay, and then they touched on the circularly moving detectors with constant velocity in the Minkowski vacuum. They said that we conclude thus that there is no mixing between positive and negative energy modes between the two sets. As a result, the Minkowski vacuum coincides with a vacuum state defined by the rotating observers, who would correctly conclude that the response rate of the co-rotating detectors confined inside the limiting surface vanishes. So that seems like they're arguing against the Unruh effect in circular scenarios.
So exactly the opposite of these other guys who say it's something that we've already seen.
And then the next part, they got into the weak decay of non-inertial protons that kind of blew my mind. They get into that in some detail. They talked about the change in the Bremsstrahlung of a uniformly accelerated charge. Let's see, it will turn out that the Rindler photons with zero energy, which are characterized by their transverse momenta, play a central role. So that's kind of weird. We've got photons with transverse momenta and zero energy that are playing a role in the Bremsstrahlung spectrum of a charged particle. Let's see, and then they got into some detail discussing about how that works. And yeah, then they got into experimental proposals. So they looked at electrons and particle accelerators. We talked about that. Electrons and Penning traps. One of the things that came up in both of those analyses that I thought was interesting was that even though they seem to disregard the contribution from circular rotation, any oscillation in the perpendicular direction does count towards the Unruh effect. So if you could make electrons in a Penning trap or in a circular accelerator oscillate up and down really quickly as they're going in a circle, then you might be able to detect some of these effects. They looked at atoms in microwave cavities, and, you know, after reading their analysis, it just doesn't look like a promising way forward. They looked at back reaction radiation in ultra-intense lasers, and that was interesting, but in a situation like that, you've got so much basically energy noise going on that trying to isolate the Unruh effect in that scenario is just isolated in an extremely powerful linear accelerator, you know? Like, how do you get the noise level down to the point where you can detect this incredibly subtle effect? But one of the things that I had never heard of before that seemed interesting was there's anomalies in the thermal spectra in the hadron collisions. And they seem to think that some of the emissions of particles, I guess mostly photons in those interactions, could be a signature of the Unruh effect. And that's interesting because we've got tons of data on that. So if that signal is there, it might be possible to tease it out.
Well, possibly. I'm not sure how. But
they also talked about the dynamical Casimir effect.
What is the dynamical Casimir effect?
I don't know. I was going to ask you. They call it the Mohr effect also. And they show a relationship where, you know, the Mohr effect is related to the Hawking radiation, which is related to the Unruh effect. So they think there was like a indirect relationship there. I think what they're talking about is, I think I remember reading some articles about this now, where they create materials where they can rapidly change like the index of refraction, or other kind of like electronic analogs for moving mirrors, that kind of thing. And I think that they've used these kind of experiments to test like the Schwinger mechanism, but I guess they can also use it to detect like really rapid acceleration environments like the Unruh effect. So I think that you just change the properties. Instead of making an acceleration, a physical acceleration, that you can change the physical properties so quickly that they're equivalent, you know, mathematically to an analog of acceleration and thereby produce, you know, indirect effects that might be measurable, right? I think they may have succeeded in creating like photon pairs or something using that kind of technique, or maybe it was an analog of photon pairs, but like, there's certain scenarios where the index of refraction can be changed very dramatically in an incredibly short period of time within a material. And apparently that gives you, you know, a means by which to test some of these effects, you know.
That would be odd because, I mean, when you're doing that, you've already got a lot of interactions, right, between the photon and the atoms in the material. So, you know, in a way you're slowing down light, but the light was already being slowed down and changed by its interactions, not, you know, not a regular kind of slowing down that we think of as, you know, just not going as fast. Yeah, the Einstein equations as an equation of state. That's interesting. What did you conclude from all this, Randy?
That I've still got an enormous amount to learn about the most cutting-edge theoretical physics of...
of the 1970s?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a very, very vibrant area of research. A physical effect that touches on pretty much all of the most interesting controversies and progress being made in theoretical physics. So I'm glad we had a chance to look at it. I think I've got to read this paper a couple more times, but fortunately it's really well written. So,
former reading group, right?
Yeah.
Like I said, you can read a paragraph. The next person can read a paragraph. You can all discuss it over your wine.
Oh, another statement that they made at the end of the paper in their concluding remarks, this was actually in the following paper on the physical meaning of the Unruh effect. They said that a positive cosmological constant should eventually be radiated away to zero. That's really interesting.
But that's not what it looks like is happening, right?
Yeah, that seems to be the inverse of what's happening, right? Because things are accelerating.
I mean, it would be interesting to see exactly how this relates to the cosmological constant, because it could.
Yeah, I'd love to see a look at that, because, you know, we've got a cosmological horizon all around us. I'd love to know what the Unruh effect has to say about that. I mean, we've got a positive cosmological constant in this universe, right?
That's what I heard.
So they're calling that a de Sitter space, right? We've talked about both of those, but then they get kind of jumbled up because you talk about them both so much. De Sitter space is the maximally symmetric vacuum solution of Einstein's field equations with a positive cosmological constant corresponding to a positive vacuum energy density and negative pressure. Yeah, so that's why our universe is expanding, right? That's what that's the leading model anyway, right? But unfortunately, the theory seems to be predicting that should be falling off instead of increasing. But on the other hand, it did fall off for a long time. We still don't really understand the seesaw mechanism there that makes it go one way and then the other.
Well, yeah, that's kind of tough. That usually it's one way or the other. But, I mean, you've got another couple of weeks to figure that out before the next episode.
Yeah, that's right, because we've still got to get that Nobel Prize, right? I was kind of surprised that Unruh didn't get a Nobel Prize for this work, because this is great work, and here it is 43 years later, and it's still incredibly relevant and controversial and confusing as hell. Usually, you know, breakthrough that big, you expect some bling.
Yeah, I think he's doing perfectly well. And he's done this, and he's doing more good stuff that you want to look at. What was it again?
Oh, well, he apparently has a view of quantum field theory, which is local. So I want to know how that works, you know. I wonder how he pulls that off. Maybe he's jumped on the retrocausality bandwagon.
I don't think so, but, I mean, you can ask him.
All right. We'll call him up.
Just look up his number on the faculty page. Everything will be okay. I mean, I'm sure he gets calls from people like us all the time.
I bet he does. Probably more than he'd like.
Yeah, probably I should cut that out so that nobody actually does that just because I told you to.
That's good. We don't want to have any, like, legal, you know, action taken against us. Yeah, these assholes. I'm trying to teach class here. I got 5,000 emails. Okay, so is there anything else in here that you wanted to talk about that you thought might be interesting or illuminating?
I think we hit everything that I remember.
All the hot points, anyway.
You got everything that was sexy in this, Randy. Now, I just step back and don't demystify this for people, because, you know, you want them to enjoy it as much as you did.
And to be as confounded as I am. That's the key. That's why we do a physics podcast, is to keep them all baffled. All right, everyone. Thanks for putting up with this. We'll come at you again with another beguiling mystery of quantum theory or general relativity in the next episode of Physics Frontiers.
Okay. Talk to you later, Randy.
See you, Jim.
No, I should not press the little red button. You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 49, The Unruh Effect. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com. And when you go there, there will be the papers we read for this episode. There'll be related episodes, whatever I think is related, basically. And anything else that we talked about in this podcast, William Hart's Geometry and Light, I'll put a link up to that somewhere or something like that. Hopefully that's useful to you. You can also leave comments on specific episodes there as well. Bye now.